Wednesday, Peter Chancet, Bible study on John, and the topic for today is the shepherd gives life. And for those of you who aren't in the tape control room, it's right up there. The shepherd gives life, John 10. And I put some reminders up there. One of the suggestions I have made for the week is that every time we see the word life, we think the equation life equals struggle. Not that this is the only meaning of the word life in John, because life in John has the other big concepts, truth, light, and I'll start with those, or bread and water and all those big words. They all have multi-dimensional meanings. Now, just to set the stage again, Monday we looked at John 5, 19 to 29, and really concentrated on two verses back to back, both which dealt with life, and our topic that day was life here and now. The first verse we concentrated on was, "Truly, truly, I say to you, anyone who believes has already crossed over from life to death. This person does not come into the judgment, but has already passed into the sphere of life, into the creative struggle, which is here and now." The other verse was chapter 5, verse 25. I guess the first one was 24, which was more traditional view that there are some living now, or the hour is coming when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God and come to life, some to the resurrection of judgment and some to the resurrection of life. Then Tuesday, yesterday, we zeroed in on the first of the signs, the wedding at Cana. And remember, we read that text twice, and the point I tried to make each time was that in this small incident, deliberately and really brilliantly crafted by the Johannine community and the Johannine authors, you have, and I think we listed five, didn't we, major motifs in John's gospel already set into motion or put into the symphony. Those motifs, O woman, sign, glory, my hour, and such dimensions. Then we also made the point that John's gospel is an invitation to the believers to see all of life through the signs, and mainly through the great sign, the one that is lifted up and will draw all people to it, him, the one who on the cross dies in the moment, the hour of glory. And then the other part of the thing was that the Gospel of John invites us to see all of, or to discern in all of our life and all our life long, signs of the times, the signs of life. And then at the end, without leaving you any time for discussion, I suggested a number of signs that I see in my life, and suggested that they will become meaningful windows onto reality when we see these signs in relation to the great sign, the one who is lifted up as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, and would draw all people to this sign, a sign which would give life or struggle. And that was our transition into the text for today, and the theme the shepherd gives life. And I want to justify my cutesy title by saying it has two dimensions of meaning, that the shepherd gives his life, and in giving his life, gives the gift of life to those who believe, and that's a big word in John, who have looked at the either or, either Jesus of Nazareth is God's message to humankind, and that has all kinds of implications, or not. Okay, now today, I want us to look at the Good Shepherd text, but I want us to do it sort of in a semi-orderly way. I want us first to look at the frame that the author or authors of this gospel put around this story, not only to let us hear it the way it was originally heard, but also to illustrate the way the writer of the fourth gospel, or the writers, or the community that developed it, the liturgical committee that finally worked on the last redaction, the worship committee, and see how, again, the motifs, the moments, the themes of John are used deliberately out of the first part of John to frame the next drama or motif that comes up, the Good Shepherd motif. So we'll look at the frame, then we'll look at the text itself, and then we'll look at the echo of this text, which is also very typical of John's way of writing. First of all, the frame, and I've got the references listed up here. John 9:35 to 41, John 10:19 to 21. The text that was used for the Vespers Monday night, where she retold the story of the man born blind in terms of the gay person who had faced and seen his or her own identity. And the last, we were talking about it last night, the last section of that text, verses 35 to 41, is particularly distinctive or characteristic of John's distinctive way. John invites you in to an area, doesn't give you an easy truth, but sets language up and the reality up in such a way that you have to really think about it and struggle about it. So let's have somebody read the first side of the frame, the brackets, 9:35 to 41. Who will do that, please?
Jesus heard that they cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?"
Now, remember, the if you haven't reread it, the man who was born blind was giving praise to Jesus, and the Jewish authorities really worked him over. They said, "You were born in utter sin. How are you trying to instruct us?" The authorities come to his parents, and the parents back off. They say, "I'm not going to touch this. You talk to him. He's of age." And then he gets kind of fresh with them. He said, "Do you want to become his disciples?" Or, you know, and he said, "If he's got a demon, how come a man with a demon can open my eyes?" And so the situation really deteriorated between him and the authorities, and they cast him out. That's where you picked it up.
He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who speaks to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind.
Okay, now read that again and just take that verse in context and place it next to your traditional understanding of who our Jesus is. Is this the Jesus that we know? Read it again.
Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard this, and they said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains."
Now let me just pause, taking this thing for itself. Is it immediately clear to you what that means?
No.
No. It's like what a real parable is. A real parable is distinct from an allegory. Invites you in to a new world of thought. An allegory is kind of a riddle. It's got a message, and once you crack the riddle, you understand it. And you can throw away the rest. Not a parable or a sign or this kind of Johannine recasting of the Jesus message. Now that you say, or if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, "We see," your guilt and your blindness remains. That is confrontative. That is very confrontative. Okay, let's do the other part of the frame. 10:19-21.
There was again a division among the Jews because of these words. Many of them said, "He has a demon, and he is mad. Why listen to him?" Others said, "These are not the sayings of one who has a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind?"
Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? A very dramatic way back to Jesus' statement, are the works that I do an indication that I come from God or not? And remember, works, for works you read sign. Now, I listen to these texts in terms of our, we're going to have this forum Thursday night about, what's the title we finally decided on? He's the title man in the area.
Christians and the Anguish of the Jews.
Christians and the Anguish of the Jews. And one of the thing that I'm supposed to talk about, and by the way, I've got it ready, written out here, is how the Gospel of John can fuel and has fueled Christian anti-Semitism. But now this is kind of an interesting one because in this little passage, you've got some who do and some who don't. It's differentiated. But the point, the literary point I'm making right now, is that the writer or writers or the worship committee that finally put it together this way said, we're going to frame the story of the Good Shepherd in terms of asking our readers to remember the story and the implications and the interpretation of the man was born blind and then came to see, and keeping in mind also, for the richness of the interpretation, the Pharisees who thought they saw but were blind. Now, that's the frame. Just let that sort of resonate around us as we read the text. Now, there's a very wonderful New Testament scholar by the name of J.A.T. Robinson who wrote a little very learned monograph on the shepherd texts that we're going to be reading. And he says about this that we see in the stuff we're about to read the wreckage of two parables fused into one. That's not a good way to talk about sacred scripture, is it? This passage, this passage is the wreckage of two parables fused into one. I think there are other ways of talking about it, but there are at least two things going on in what we're about to read. So let's read it and then go at the analysis. And let's try to get as many voices into this as possible. So read a sentence starting at John 10:1 and reading loudly and clearly for me, because I'm also getting a little deaf, and for the tape. Okay? Anybody to start?
Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep.
To him the gatekeeper opens, the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out.
When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice.
A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers.
Now, okay, this next verse, I'm going to pause before that. J.A.T. Robinson called this the wreckage of two parables fused into one. Isn't entirely out in left field, because even the authors or author of this text indicate in the next verse that it was kind of hard for them to understand, or even the original people. Read number 6.
Jesus used this figure of speech with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them.
Okay, that's...
That kind of notation appears frequently.
Yes, all over. That's one of John's tricks, is the misunderstanding. Everybody sort of misunderstands, and then they move through this misunderstanding to a deeper knowledge of what faith means, what Jesus the I Am means. But it's also legitimate to use it the way I did, because this is tough stuff. Okay, go on to the next one.
So Jesus said again, I am telling you the truth. I am the gate of the sheep. All others who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever comes in by me will be saved. He will come in and go out. Oh,
okay, next.
The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy.
Say that again.
The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy.
Those are pretty strong words, aren't they?
I came that they may have life and have it abundantly.
I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep.
He who is a hireling and not a shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them.
He flees because he is a hireling and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. And I lay down my life for the sheep.
But there are other sheep of mine not belonging to this fold whom I must bring in, and they too will listen to my voice.
So there shall be one flock, one shepherd. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I might take it again.
No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This charge I have received from my Father.
Now, in the richness of this text, there are at least two dimensions that are there powerfully that I am not going to emphasize in this one short hour. But before we get into looking at the shepherd figure, I want to just touch on those two motifs. The one is there are other sheep that are not of this fold, I must bring them also, and they will heed my voice. This motif reappears particularly in the so-called high priestly prayer of Jesus in chapter 17, a passage that has been quoted again and again and again by the ecumenical movement. We're not going to talk about that right now, but it will pick it up a little bit when we talk about life for the world on Friday. That's one dimension that we're going to neglect, that's there powerfully. The other dimension that we're going to neglect, because I've got a particular agenda, is the marvelously comforting and powerful motif of hear my voice and know my voice, the inner dynamic of the beloved community, or the community of the beloved disciple, the community of the loving Jesus. Those are all there, and I don't want to deny them, but I want to look at what I think, or I know in my life, has been a neglected dimension of this passage. Now, I'm really very sorry that I didn't erase this, but I will now. Maybe you didn't see it. And we're going to have a little examination here. Fill in the blank. What I am statements do we have in this text? I am
the Good Shepherd.
And what's the other one?
The gate.
I am the door or gate. Now, how does that fit together? Is that the wreckage of two images or parables that have been somewhat awkwardly fused together? Yeah, you can talk about it that way. But you...
Why?
Don't come in. Come in with that later. You got to give me a little lead. I mean, I went through this with the shorter version this morning, and that will come in. I think I know what you're going to say, but hold it a minute. We haven't had collusion here. He isn't working on my team. Okay. Part of, you know, the two, if you're going to go at it really logically, that doesn't make sense. If you go at it the way John does, I think, it's like a picture. Two images imposed on top of each other. Now, what were you going to say? Were you going to talk about the shepherd sleeping at the gate door to protect the sheep? Okay, that's another one. And I'm going to load your image a little bit and say the supine shepherd sleeping at the gate of the round enclosure where the sheep come at night. And so the shepherd lays there and is both the door and the shepherd. And that one can work, except when you get into some of the details here, you've got something else. Now, I want us to look both in the door image and in the shepherd image at the conflict or struggle images. Who are the thieves and robbers? And what do they want to do? I had you, who was it over here that was reading? I had you reread it. They come to steal, kill, destroy. And if you go at and read through, page through the modern commentators, I don't have the language ability to read the old commentators in Latin and so forth, they will give different labels to the thieves and robbers. Some will say it's the Pharisees of Jesus' time. Some will say theologically it's even Moses and the prophets because they were so imperfect. Some will say it was the false teachers and so forth of the conflicted time from 30 or from 50 to 110 Common Era when the Johannine community was putting together these documents and revising them, and when the Johannine community or the community of the Beloved Disciple was that historical meteor that came and then fizzled out. And the interesting thing is that the commentators will have good arguments for all, but not a conclusive argument for any of these theories. And that's another dimension, I think, a genius of John's choice and presentation of images, is that you can fill in the blank there with almost anything from any age. But behind that specific, I want to go to the dramatic general point, and that is that here we have again the image of conflict. Now that's around the door dimension, around the shepherd dimension, and that's why, see, I didn't give you a chance to really say what you wanted to say, but in the earlier session, somebody spoke very beautifully about what you find in a lot of the Bible handbooks, that the shepherd slept in that position at night because the shepherd was the protective door of the even vulnerable sheepfold. But that is not the dramatic image that you find down there. Somebody read again 12 and just let your mind image it. Read 12 following.
He who is a hireling and not a shepherd, whose own the sheep are not, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees.
Okay, what's the drama there? Now it could be the supine shepherd sleeping. Sleeping at the sleep gate. Okay, it could be the supine shepherd sleeping at the sheep gate. That's decaf that does that. Okay. But the picture itself is a picture of action and drama. He's running. Okay, keep going. But the shepherd does what?
And the wolf snatches them and gathers them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hireling and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me. As the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep.
Now, how does in this image, how does the shepherd lay down life? If you stick with this image, and let's do it for a while, the shepherd lays down life in struggle and combat with the enemy, the wolf, right? Isn't that the image that if we read this without our traditional piety for the first time, that's the image we'd get. You're going to say something.
Just that I think he's already shifted gears. There's been two references to I am the door, and now there's a reference to I am the good shepherd. And the rest of the context that you just read follows that second one. So it's as though, I've always felt that Jesus was just saying, let's look at it a couple of ways. I'm the good shepherd in the sense that I am a door, and the sheep go in and out. Because the shepherd's function as the door at night was far more to keep sheep in than to keep the other threats out. Because if the sheep got antsy,
now that's what you are taking as an interpreter, as a good interpreter, from the image. What the text here is emphasizing, and that's my emphasis, is that there is conflict both around the image of the door and around the image of the sheep. Yes, sir?
Just since we're working with nonviolence a bit here, yes. It's a wonderful nonviolent image because he might have said, I defend the sheep by killing the wolf. No, but he says, I lay down my life.
Exactly. Now you're, now you see everybody, that you, when you let them talk, they steal all your thunder. That's the problem. That's why my Professor Rosenthal's never let us discuss. He wouldn't have had nothing, he wouldn't have anything left to say at the end of the lecture. Absolutely. That's where we're coming around to. That's where we're coming around to, it seems to me. But, okay, I interrupted you. What were you saying? Okay. Now, what I want to do is... Yes, sir.
I just had a question. In let's see, verse where it talks about the says I the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I come that they may have life and have it abundantly. Is it referring to the sheep or the thief?
I mean, if you preach it and write a good sermon, you can make it refer to the thief. I think it's referring to the sheep right now. That's what I think the thief. But you see, when I said that, because John leaves the door open for all kinds of interpretation, and particularly when you come around to the, and when you come to this thing we're going to do Friday, where I repeat it again and again because it's something you have to work on and work on and think on. For God so loved the world. The world is both the object of God's love and the enemy. And the enemy at the same time. That's the dynamic there. Well, let me, since it's a little bit re-understanding of this text, let me start it by telling a story. I grew up in Mauston, Wisconsin, in a beautiful, beautiful, green, rural Norwegian ghetto that my mother's grandparents had immigrated to in the 1840s. And I went to the same country church that my grandparents had helped establish. I must have listened to, seemed like, 10,000 sermons, none of them shorter than an hour. Reverend Rustin never preached shorter than over an hour. I remember when he had a special children's sermon and I had a new Mickey Mouse watch. I clocked it at an hour and 2 minutes and it was one of the shorter ones. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes your mind wanders a bit in these sermons, which include hymns and a review of the catechism and everything. And the altarpiece in front was the Good Shepherd. And remember those wonderful altar paintings, you know, with all these things up that were half gold and half white, and then the altar rail that was painted gold and white, and then you had the velvet kneeling thing that the women of the church, then called the ladies' aid, brushed off, and it was even before vacuum cleaners were brought over to the church. And there it was, the Good Shepherd holding in this arm a little lamb that had a, looked like three legs, but it was only two legs hanging down, and then around his feet three or four sort of stoic, dull Norwegian looking sheep wondering kind of where they, why they were there. And then over that a lovely ornate frame that looked a little bit like the altar itself, and then two doves, sort of looking down, looking like big pigeons, looking down at the Good Shepherd. And I could never figure out as a kid why Jesus was, the shepherd was standing in this door. Well, of course, it was the two images superimposed on him. He was both the door and the shepherd. But think of how passive that picture was. And I can't remember when I saw this picture. I was in Europe as an army chaplain. We went to all the museums, and then we worked with LWF for 3 years and went to all the art museums. And I can't honestly remember where it was or who did it. But I remember in one art museum coming around the corner and seeing this sort of dark picture of a man crouching with a knife and a big sort of medieval line, not a wolf, but a line over there, and then some sheep over here. This guy standing between this attacking line and the sheep. has a funny picture. And I went over, and this is a cultural confession, I went over, I couldn't believe, coming from my background, the title, The Good Shepherd. So some artist had seen in this passage what I had never seen and had never been allowed to see because of my cultural training and presuppositions. And as I see you guys standing here as symbols and signs of nonviolence, I want to say it was not because I came out of a pacifistic tradition, and to be unfair and simplistic, it was because I came out of a passive tradition. Our good shepherd was not supine in front of the sheepfold. That would have been even more dynamic if we'd understood it. Our good shepherd was just standing there with the Norwegian sheep. And that's a very interesting thing for me. A very interesting thing for me. And I would like to suggest, and I hope it's legitimate, that there is in this text also dimensions of life or death conflict that we ought to have eyes to see. And I have had eyes trained not to see this. Now where does that lead us? Well, I hope it leads us into some discussion, but I want to pick up what you suggested. It seems to me if you look at this passage again very clearly and at the intent of the author, it is not saying that he kills the wolf, but that he gives his life. So if it's a matter of a struggle between life and death, it's the life of the shepherd that will be sacrificed. And that, and not the life of the enemy. That's why when the crucified one is raised up as Moses raised up the serpent in the wilderness, it is both a giving a life for the sheep, the shepherd gives his life for the sheep, and also the shepherd gives life to the sheep by inviting them into his struggle. Now, I said to the 9 o'clock, the staff, the shorter version group, that I get a little preachy at this point, so after I've been preachy, then we can have a discussion. It seems to me that what we're looking at is the Bishop Romero, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Bishop Gomez phenomenon. Remember Martin Luther King said, "You do not know how to live, really, until you have found something for which you can die, you're willing to die." And certainly the towering figure of Mandela, like Lazarus out of the tomb, or like the man 38 years unhealed at the portico who finally finds life. Certainly Mandela has come across our horizon as a person who is so vitally alive at 71 that he can calmly stare down and outclass the leaders of the world is because long ago he made this commitment that he would be willing to die any time for this particular cause. Gomez, Romero, the same thing. Now, I put that in front of us, and then we all get discouraged because I'm not a Gomez. I'm not a Martin Luther King. I am not a Romero. Is this irrelevant for us? And I want to say to myself and to you, I think this is not irrelevant for us. I think in terms of John's gospel, in terms of Christianity in this time, in this place, it is valid for each one of us sitting here to say, I am not really alive unless I have found something in the struggle or conflict for which I would be willing to die. And I think our modesty, our fear or something makes us unwilling to see that a lot of us have done this. A lot of us little people have done this and are called to do this. To move away from this call, I think, and to take it seriously for each one of our lives, is to trivialize the incredible gift of human existence that each one of us has been given. Now let me give you a little illustration of what I mean. I think there's all kinds of people sitting here who haven't even articulated to themselves, yes, I have made a commitment that if it came to that, I'd give my life for it. How many of you remember Murder in the Cathedral? T.S. Eliot's play? You don't seek martyrdom. You don't go out and say, by golly, here I am. I'm going to stand in between the hail of bullets and down I'll go and I'll be a martyr, by golly. No, that's not the way it goes. That's not the way it goes. But I think in terms of our commitment to our children, in terms of our commitment to our causes, to our struggle, which means life for us, all kinds of people here who've said that and mean that. My other story, and then I'm going to quit and we can talk. In the last 5 years in Denver, I've gone every Sunday morning to the 7:45 worship at Shorter AME Church, African Methodist Episcopal, because I feel that as a Lutheran sheep, I need the vitality that comes out of the black community. I just need it. I think I mentioned to this group earlier, and I'll repeat it now because we've got a little bit of time. Pete Pirro, a black Lutheran professor from LSTC in Chicago, coming to a symposium we had at Wartburg Seminary on worship and so forth. And he talked about the worship life in the black community. And he said, you white folks, you've heard me tell you this before, but I'm reminding you of it. You white folks come to church and look for relevance. We black folks come to church because it's the only way we're going to get through the next week. It's the only way we're going to get through the next week. So that's one of the reasons I keep going to this church. They had a day-long symposium at Shorter AME. It's a very powerful black church. They just built a new structure for about $2 million. And they're middle class, but they're Christians, and they say, we are responsible for the situation in the black community in Denver. So this day-long symposium, first on AIDS in the teenage community and the tragic death of so many babies born with AIDS, and then the other section on drugs and gangs, and then the third section on what we can do intergenerationally to band together and in the struggle. Well, there's a guy I know, a little my age, 60-ish, that I really talked to casually but didn't know him well. Big, tall, handsome guy whose kids are raised, and he was on the program, to my surprise, is one of the Mad Dads. Now, do you know what the Mad Dads are of Omaha? They are the black fathers who say black male, the black male in the United States is not set up to be counted. And they go out and confront the young gang members. And this guy has gone with about five or six people from Shorter to these rumbles, I guess they used to call them, I don't know what they now call them, at after games, after sports events and other things. And he said, people tell me I'm putting my life on the line. And he said, maybe I am. But he said, I'm sick and tired of having the helicopters fly over my neighborhood where I raised my kids. He said, we're going to take care of it on the ground. And he said, every time I've gone to these kids and talked to them, he said, they've said, these kids that everybody's afraid of, that the cops are afraid of, that other gang members are afraid of, every time he said, they've said to me, thanks for coming. Thanks for coming. And he said, people tell me my life is on the line. And he said, maybe, but I don't worry about that. He's a little guy like you and me. That's his commitment. And it seems to me that the great sign of the Good Shepherd who actually had to give his life, and we can look at why, and we'll, I think we'll do that when we get to the section on life for the world. That is a valid sign for each one of us. The shepherd gives life by giving his life, and in that mysterious drawing symbol gives us our life. Anyone who believes that this is God's central revelation, God's central sign, has already passed from death to life. It does not come into the judgment. Now, we got 15 minutes to talk, because maybe I'm wrong. What was it? Did it resonate with anything in your experience to say we don't want to look at the conflict, the struggle, the life and death dimension, either of this text or where we live daily?
One of the things, I mean, this is so rich, it just all kinds of stuff keeps coming out at me.
Well, let's get something out of here so we don't have silence. What are they doing in the tape room?
One of the things that it reminds me of was in the Narnia stories of Aslan, and when he, the lion that is kind of a Christ figure, and that when in the confrontation with, was it an evil witch or something, and what ends up happening is that it becomes clear that Aslan is not going to fight and kill the witch, which would be what you'd expect in most stories of that kind, but that he's going to allow the witch to kill him. And I can remember, even as a person with a deep belief in nonviolence, feeling upset that Aslan wasn't going to stand up. I mean, he's this big lion, you know, he could have.
And you see, that's such a, it's such a hard line, because remember the lament that came through the symposium Monday night? Barb saying, where's the resistance? Where's the protest? And somebody in the early session said, well, is that our battlefield? That we're going to protest this very complex, simplistically, protest this very complex move in Saudi Arabia. And I think the group, the earlier session, said, no, that's not the issue. The issue is, where is your struggle? Which is the struggle that you see, you've been able to see? And then are we going to move from passivity to action, or to standing up in our struggle? It seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, but in all the riches and wonderfulness of being a Lutheran, seems to be there's still something to the historical description of us as somewhat passive.
It's almost as though Jesus is, after he says, I will lay down my life for the sheep, he's trying to counter any idea of passivity by saying, now look, no one takes it from me. I lay it down of my own. I have the power to lay it down.
I'm a free agent.
You know, I'm a free agent.
I'm a free agent. And in freedom, I choose this path. Mm-hmm. Yeah, were you scratching your ear or raising your hand?
Me?
Yeah.
I was just going to say this is a different way of looking at it, but abortion and the issue of abortion, you don't dare say what you are, because no matter what you say you are, they have an argument about it. You know, like now, if I say I'm pro-choice, then they tell me, then you believe in abortion. I said, not necessarily so. So we get on this kick, and no matter what you say, it's not the right thing. And it's a real struggle with me because I have a hard time understanding how people, you know.
Okay, let's talk about that a little bit. It seems to me that every one of us runs from certain battles.
Yeah.
I mean, when I look at my own life, when I talk big about being in the struggle, the only struggle I've really been in terms of societal injustice struggles is the last 15 years, sort of tagging along with my wife on Namibia. And that's partly because I'm a person and not God. You can't fight every battle. You can't fight every struggle. And you have friends who are in other struggles, like Sister Dorothy Marie Hennessy, my longtime friend from Dubuque, Iowa, whose brother is a Marinole father in Guatemala, and he's been in Nicaragua and so forth. I call her up and I say, Dorothy Marie, we've got to write a letter. What should I be writing? Because I don't keep up on that one. It's hard enough to keep up on the details, and you fight battles in terms of advocacy, in terms of the details, the next issue. It's hard enough to keep up on Namibia and South Africa. So not everybody can join every battle, but seems to me that each one of us finds that thing for which he or she will take the guff of being misunderstood. Now, I don't know whether the abortion thing is your battle.
Well, it just seems like no matter what you say, it's not the right thing. And I feel like I'm entitled to feel the way I feel, whether it's right or wrong. Because feelings are feelings, and we have, in particular, one lady in our church that, I mean, you don't get on the subject, because if you do, you'd be there all day long, because she can quote all these terrible things, you know.
I don't even know what to do with that, because, okay, you say what you're going to say.
I just wanted to tell her that I commend her. I think it's not so much that you win the argument, that you stand up and that you speak. And you'll find other people that you'll strengthen in your groups who have the ability to come in and maybe argue, or that you will strengthen to think about the struggle that you have. So I commend her for standing up. It's not winning. It's being able to stand up and voice what you believe. You strengthen others around you by doing that.
It's very interesting, the word struggle that I sort of raised up in my Bible study was the same word that Steve, you were there yesterday, lifted up, and he said that's what creativity is, getting into the struggle. And I don't know where that's leading, but I do think that putting yourself on the line is being alive. That's what it's all about. You were going to say something, Mark?
I was just going to say the paradox with the abortion issue is your model of finding a struggle that's so meaningful that you would give your life for it, that people on both sides of the issue
yep.
have been moved to that position.
Yep.
And it's full and meaningful on both sides, and it's paradoxical because there's a difference.
But does that mean we should run from the battle? I don't know. I mean, that one's, I must say, I run from that battle, yes.
I think it's also the fact that you try to avoid the struggle, it's so harmful. For example, when they have an abortion issue, I think the hard thing to face is that you're killing a person. Now, we do this all the time, whether it be in battle
or whether we have policemen who are out there to put their lives on the line. So we choose that it's okay for people to die under certain circumstances. But I think if you avoid the fact that you're killing a person, I think that you're simply misleading yourself. You can't come to any kind of, that's where the struggle is. Are you going to sacrifice a person for another person or not? Now, that is struggling. What happens? You don't have a win-loss situation. You don't struggle and come out of it and a winner. You struggle and there's always a loss somewhere along the way, whether it's lies or something.
See, if I were in the abortion struggle rather than on the sidelines, I guess I would fight for broadening the issue and saying, what is life? What is life? I mean, there are some people in the abortion struggle on the side of anti-abortion people for whom I have profound respect, because they say the issue is life from cradle to grave, and there are all kinds of people living now who are not living. But that's one hard for me to get in. Yeah.
I want to raise a question that's not on abortion.
Okay, good. Okay.
Back to the passage. When the part that says, all who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not heed them. Mm. There's a sense of arrogance when I hear that. And that was the first reaction I had. I mean, how dare he discount so many people who came before? And it raises, at that moment, that sense of discomfort. But then I wonder what happens, or how would people interpret people who, and this is Christians as well as non-Christians, who do not believe that Jesus is the only manifestation of God. And I know a lot of folks, including nuns, and others who have totally dedicated their life to official religious life, who don't believe Jesus is the Messiah, who don't believe that the only manifestation of God. And how do you work this biblical passage and claims when you were talking about he is or he isn't?
Well,
how do you deal with the whole Christian world?
Let's get it out on the table even more radically, and then I can say how I do or don't. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. You can't get more exclusive than that. And I guess the way I have to handle that is, in the first instance, to listen to that thing or to look at it, trying not to blind my eyes. That's part of what we're going to be talking about tomorrow night, And the rage that is on every page here of the leaders of the Jews and some of the Jews who do not believe is there. That is arrogance. That is blasphemy. And so the Christian community in honesty has to look at that and say, first, two things. Is that what the Gospel of John and behind it Jesus' claim was? And probably you have to say, yes. And then in this absolute either or, you have to go the second step on that. Maybe this may be cheating, but I would say, and then you have to look at what we've already looked at, and Jesus saying, or the stance, it's a matter of life and death, but it'll be my death rather than yours. Now, I don't know if that's a way out or not, because it seems to me that in the tradition of all the four Gospels, the death was for all. And we're back to a deepened understanding of John 3:16. Even though the world, and let me, my little prepared thing for tomorrow night, the Jews are a symbol in John's Gospel, I think, for those who did not believe, particularly the leaders, but when it's also, and so the world and the Jews are put together as those who have said no to the big either or. The death is still in love for those. That's what I think is at the depth of Christian theology, yes.
Well, it is a terribly exclusive sounding statement. And I think that the context for it is the context of many claimed messiahs. And there were indeed in this time many. That Jesus is saying, among those who claim exclusive representation of God, they have been thieves and robbers. And I would turn to a non-Christian, Gamaliel, who says in the fifth chapter of Acts, men of Israel, take care of what you do with these men. For before these days, Judas arose, giving himself out to be somebody, the interpreted Messiah, and so forth. And then he says, after Judas the Galilean, and there have been others.
Let me just close it off with a little story, because I think it raises it. And Jim knows this guy, Martin Luther Kretzmann. Remember Martin Luther Kretzmann? I call him the best of the Kretzmanns. Jody isn't here now, so I can call him. But he's Jody's uncle. And he spent how many years in India, Jim? 23 years. And is a Missouri Lutheran theologian who has, for my money, the best mission theology out. And he was facing this exclusive claim. And the exclusive claim, when we were at seminary, I remember in prayer mission corridor, prayer fellowship, we would pray for those people that were going to hell if they didn't know Jesus, right? So that was what formed us. And Martin Luther Kretzmann was out in India, and he lectured our seminary once and said, I believe that the history, culture, and religion of India is one legitimate pointer toward God. And all the conservative Lutherans couldn't quite get the message, and after a while they said, well, what about I am the way, the truth, and the life? No one comes to the Father but by me. And Martin Luther Christian gave an answer which came out of his struggle, and you may or may not buy it, but I feel comfortable with it. He said, I had to believe that the culture, religion, and history of India was pointing towards the real God. He said, anyone, any mother who stands before God and cries out for the health of her child who's ill, if there is a God, God will not say, sorry, wrong name. God will hear. He said, but he said, I stayed in India because I believed that all this was pointing to the final revelation in Jesus. His stance was that you do not condemn, you just hold the stance.